This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics. And a crucial case is being heard by the Supreme Court this week. It's all about Quebec's secularism law, which bans public servants, including teachers, from wearing overt religious symbols. That means a hijab or a cross or a kippah, among other things, also a turban or a kirpan. So the word is that it's unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court is hearing that, but there's an even more critical question behind that, which is a question of minority rights protected, and that is the use of the notwithstanding clause, because the Quebec government has used the notwithstanding clause to override charter concerns. And the question behind it all is, can the provinces just do that? The notwithstanding clause allows provincial premiers to override laws they don't like, and that is how Pierre Trudeau got the Charter of Rights agreed to. So this is unfolding. We probably won't get a decision for a very long time, but it is something that we really need to discuss. There's also plenty at the provincial level, a whole variety of subjects that the Premier, Doug Ford, was signaling last week with what I call flights of Fordism. And I wonder, was at least some of that a way to distract from the provincial budget, which is coming in just 2 days, and which the word is will be an austerity budget. So I am hoping that the panel can help us understand what that is likely to mean. So people, we want to hear from you. 866-744-740. That's our text line and our long distance phone line, local phone line, 416-360-0740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, a former Ontario Liberal MPP, Health Minister and Deputy Premier. Lisa Raitt, a former Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party. And Peter Tabbins, a current Ontario NDP MPP for Toronto Danforth. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thanks, Libby.
Great to be here.
Okay. I'm going to begin with Lisa, because when we were talking about all these various things Ford was talking about in his inimitable way, and you said, well, you think he's just throwing stuff up to see what will stick. So what, in your view, is sticking?
Would appear he's serious about the Island Airport, because he actually went down there to make the announcement. So I think that appears to be sticking. I'm shocked to hear that's an austerity budget. Perhaps, Libby, that's why all of these things are being thrown out now, to kind of distract from what could be a lot of cuts that aren't going to be comfortable for a lot of people. But the I don't know where he's landed on the other stuff. I suppose we'll find out if it's in the budget speech or if he introduces it in legislation as it goes along. But so far, I don't see him backing down from any of the stuff that he's talked about.
Boy, he was really angry yesterday when he was talking about this limitation of freedom of information that we've been talking about. And he's saying no one cares about it except for the opposition and the media, George. And I'm thinking maybe he is right about that. I would love it if people cared about it, but I'm not sure they do.
Well, if the tactic is designed to cover up information with respect to scandals like those that went on with respect to the Greenbelt, I think some people will actually be concerned about it. I thought his arrogance on this point, saying, well, I'm so popular, if I had an election today, the people would still vote for me, is not a good look for him. And I just remind him to take a look 2 years back at the popularity of the Premier of Quebec, who's now in the doldrums. And the minute that the smoke clears from Trump, Ford is going to be under the gun, I'm quite sure, for the poor performance in public services, especially healthcare, which is in really rough shape in quite a few parts of the province of Ontario. And I think that this next action of waste on the waterfront, he's going into this another blind effort like he did with Ontario Place, where he predicted a $600 million expenditure that became billions. So I don't really know how that stands out as austerity.
Yeah, but again, if he was going on with great conviction, I mean, people walking around wondering how they're affording their groceries or wondering how they're going to access health care, that are they worried about limitations on freedom of information? I think he might be right on that, George, before we move along.
Well, I think FOI ends up being, I suppose, a bit of an inside baseball story. Like, I do understand the point there. But fundamentally, reflecting on your government as one which is less open, considering especially the history of scandal related to the Greenbelt, the last of which we haven't heard from, I think that the opposition parties can, over time, link those things. And I think that the way that he responded to that is damaging to his brand, because I thought he was profoundly arrogant.
Peter, I really have to take up something that your leader said that really bothered me.
And go ahead, Libby.
Okay, so we're expecting a big protest today by students against the changes to OSAP. I think it is perfectly reasonable for students to protest against that. Directly affects them for a whole variety of reasons. However, what Marit Stiles said last week, because we've seen the statues at Queen's Park being wrapped and boxed at taxpayer expense, and she said that instead of doing that, or the best way to avoid that was to reverse the changes to OSAP. And, I mean, is that saying that vandalism is the best way to solve your problems or to condone it? Those are two separate things. I think students should protest at Queen's Park, but they should not vandalize statues or any other property.
Yeah, I agree, Libby. Vandalism's wrong. Damaging public property is wrong. I don't support that, and I'm sure Marit doesn't either.
Well, she said, no, that is exactly what she said. The best way to avoid that is to change those directives or laws or, yeah, I mean.
Well, if I could jump in, Libby. If, in fact, you remove the source of the grievance, then you wouldn't have a demonstration, and you wouldn't have risk of vandalism by a few individuals who are acting stupidly and crazily. But I certainly don't think her comment endorses vandalism. What it does say is Doug Ford has created a combustible situation here in Ontario where a lot of people feel quite desperate. And frankly, he shouldn't be doing that to them. He should reverse course. Telling students that they aren't going to have a future, or they're going to have a future that's going to come with a huge mortgage, is something that is, well, ill thought at best. He needs to back off on that. And it isn't a question of vandalism. If he wants to actually have a situation where people feel, young people feel they have a future, and if we as a society want to have an educated, capable workforce in a complex world, then he should be backing off on that.
Lisa, do you see it that way?
I'm kind of in the middle. I do understand the concerns that students have with respect to payment. It's a big change, and it's going to really hurt people, quite frankly, next year. I can see that. I can also see the impact it has on our budgets, and it's about what can we afford. It's about balancing what it is that you can afford at this point in time. Is it going to be healthcare? Is it going to be education? What is it going to be? So that's a difficult thing. That's why people are elected, to make those calls. But I will say this, that I think I read, Libby, that, and I know I read it, that Ontario's granting system, where you get the money for free as opposed to a loan, is actually not in step with the other provinces across the country, that we are significantly higher. We're in the 70% range, whereas most other provinces are in the 50% range on grants and loans. I don't mind going to 50% on grants and loans, especially if you do put in place some kind of supports for people who just simply cannot get to the ability to pay tuition, even with a 50% grant. So that's what I don't want to harm the people who are truly in need by a broad brushed policy. But at the same time, there are people out there taking grants that really shouldn't be taking grants, that do have the means and do have the ways in which to pay for their full education.
Yeah, but again, I mean, those comments about the way to prevent vandalism is
oh,
just...
I see. Yeah, I'm not game for that. I don't like that. That seems to be a little bit extortionist-y.
yeah. George, do you think that this OSAP question is going to be central, or is it going to be more about healthcare? And I'm reminded, didn't Doug Ford come to power the first time saying he was going to eliminate hallway healthcare? And isn't it worse?
He did, Libby, because he told Ontario Health, I don't want you people reporting on how many people are in the hallways anymore. So, you know, with the snap of his fingers and direction to Ontario Health, hallway medicine is gone. Mind you, there's acute care wards in Ontario operating at 160%. So put that into your thinking cap. I think that this distraction around vandalism, which hasn't yet occurred, is rather ridiculous, that they're trying to take away from the significant issue at play. If thousands of people come to the lawn in Ontario, that's not an easy feat. Ontarians don't rally in the masses unless there's something really going on. I've seen that horse's balls in North Queen's Park painted so many bloody times for this reason or that. Everybody knows how to deal with that kind of vandalism that could occur, but I do think that we run the risk as affluent individuals, relatively speaking, on this panel of actually giving short shrift to the circumstances. We want to talk about affordability. Well, the affordability of families at the lower end of the spectrum being able to actually send their kids to good schools with a view towards their futures, that's fundamentally a pocketbook issue, etc. So I was on the lawn when there was a big riot on the ODSP cuts or something like that after the 99, when I was elected in 99. There were firebombs and there were bricks pulled out of the ground that were thrown at people. There were horses on the lawn and the whole bit. So I think that actually preemptively focusing on vandalism that hasn't yet occurred, to me, that's ridiculous. You can't arrest me for saying I'm going to cross your private property. I just said it. So I really think that's another part of the Ford distraction machine. And I think the speaker has unwittingly played into that in a very significant and unhelpful way.
I don't want to get into the weeds, but the speaker said it wasn't her choice to do it. She had to do it at the direction of, anyway, let's never mind that.
She runs the building and the properties. There may be other influences, but the speaker has quite a bit of authority around what happens in the legislative precinct, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise.
Okay. What about these little things for drivers, being able to have a single occupant in HOV lanes during off-peak hours, whatever they may be, being able to take booze to certain public events that are cleared in advance, all these little things, Peter.
Libby, I think it's just a continuation of the look over here, don't look here dynamic on the part of the premier. He does have a lot of big problems. Affordability is a huge issue. Healthcare, George is quite correct, things are really in bad shape. People don't like the idea of corruption. They don't like the idea of secretive government. That's a big problem for him. And frankly, given the actions he's taken, he must be hiding something really interesting in his cell phone if he won't release those records. So he's doing his best to get people's minds moved far, far away from the critical issues of the day. And I would say the things that you pointed out, Libby, are ones that really catch people's attention, but are not the critical issues that the province has to deal with today.
Yeah, exactly. Lisa, I want to pivot to talk about what is being heard this week at the Supreme Court, because this has implications for all of us. A very controversial bill in Quebec. There's secularism law. People who are paid by the public purse cannot wear overt religious symbols. And I mean, I don't know if it's clear that this is unconstitutional under the charter or the argument is being made, but the province just invokes the notwithstanding clause.
Yeah, I think the province of Quebec invokes it as a preamble to every bill that they bring in, to be honest. I think it's just part of the way in which they deal with Canada in general, how they want to be sovereign, unique, and their own nation. That being said, this one being tested at the Supreme Court will be very interesting. I spoke with Tom Mulcair yesterday, former leader of the opposition in Canada, lives in Quebec. And his point of view is that it's going to be really difficult for the Supreme Court just to say that there must be limitations on the notwithstanding clause, because there was a bargain made a long time ago that in order to get the charter into the Constitution, you needed to have this, so that provinces didn't feel like unelected courts were going to be taking decisions that they thought should have been legislative in nature. That's where it all came from. But he did say this, Libby. He said that there are parts of this whole piece that the court may look at and say, well, that really is discrimination on the basis of being a woman, and you are not allowed to breach that whatsoever. No notwithstanding clause can save you from that. And it comes down to whether women wear hijabs when they go into the classroom. So I never thought about it from that perspective. So in other words, it's going to be very technical. It's going to be very messy. But at the end of the day, the provinces will still have the rights to be able to say that the notwithstanding clause is something that they can invoke. But it may be limited by whether or not you're overtly discriminating against women.
Well, wait a minute. So does that mean we might end up with a situation where a woman can wear a hijab, but a guy can't wear a kippah?
Wear a kippah?
Or a turban? Isn't that
or something along those lines? Yeah, it could be. That's why it's going to be messy and difficult, because we do have this anachronism within our Constitution where gender equality is very different.
How is that
differently treated than the Charter?
It's not
in the Charter. It's part of the Constitution, so the notwithstanding clause doesn't apply there.
Okay, like now I'm starting to get lost in the legalities, but that seems
I went to the weeds. I'm sorry, but we'll wait to see what the in a year from now we will hear what the Supreme Court has to say. I shouldn't have gone to where Tom thinks it's going, but it's a very real live issue. It's important to the provinces. It is important to minority groups across Canada, and I think it's going to be a seminal decision of this Supreme Court just to see where they sit.
Yeah, I mean, and I want to remind people that here in Ontario, we've talked about a certain kind of frivolousness. So remind me if there was a time when Doug Ford actually invoked it. He threatened to invoke the notwithstanding clause. Remember when he reduced the number of wards in a city election? He was going to invoke the notwithstanding clause for that.
I remember that one rather well, since I was running in an open seat in my political comeback, which stalled out pretty soon thereafter. I think that for me, I'm a product of the charter. I'm a minority in the sense of my sexual orientation. That's provided me the privilege of having equality read into my ability to marry and to adopt children, etc. I'm also a secularist, so I kind of like have a little bit of a struggle there. I would say, at least, this might sound odd, but at least for Quebec's part, they're utilizing the notwithstanding clause in a fashion which is related to trampling on minority rights, as opposed to using it as Doug Ford does willy-nilly as his get-out-of-jail-free card. Like Lisa said, I'm very interested to see how the courts, or what the Supreme Court has, what flexibility it possibly has to restrict the use of it. I thought some of this was rather settled because it's been decades now since RCMP, I think perhaps first, allowed turbaned officers to wear that. That hasn't caused some societal problem, best as I could tell for me. So I'm, like I said, I'm a little bit conflicted on this, but very interested to see how the court addresses this, even if we have to wait a year.
Peter?
Yeah, my knowledge in this area is very limited, Libby, which normally is not an obstacle to a politician saying anything. That said, I would be very interested in seeing how the courts rule. I will say it's been quite shocking at Queen's Park to see how frequently the Premier wants to use notwithstanding when he runs into big problems. Obviously, the municipal elections in 2018 were one example. In the fall of 2022, he wanted to use notwithstanding powers to overrule labor rights. He doesn't seem to be particularly concerned about the laws and constitution of the nation. His Bill 5 that he wants to use to ram through the Island Airport, another example, not constitutional, but just overriding all the laws on the books. So I understand, and Lisa knows more about this than I do, that what we got with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was a compromise between the provinces and the feds. And so it ain't a perfect situation. I'm just very concerned when people use the notwithstanding clause on a regular basis.
Well, but they do.
We'll see what the Supreme Court has to say about this particular issue.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a provincial premier thing. So, you wonder at a certain point, what's the point of having a charter if anything in it can be overridden? But now you have me
only
thinking,
by
Lisa.
Four provinces.
What?
I think that's only been the practice in four provinces in
so
the country
far.
So
yeah.
far.
Yeah. However, as I was going to say, now you have, I think this possibility of allowing women to wear hijabs, but guys can't wear their religious symbols, that does not sit well with me.
I'll go figure that out a little bit better, Libby, and be more prepared to talk to you about it so that I can do a better job. But it's, I think what it comes down to is that when that clause was placed in the Constitution, I think people thought that the public would raise up and be so angered with any politician who dared use the notwithstanding clause that that was its own deterrent. And now we just see people go, eh, okay.
Well,
it's kind of like ethics violations. You kind of go, eh, whatever.
We go, eh, about a lot of things. We're going to be talking about limitations on rights to protest in our next segment. But just very quickly to touch on something that happened at City Hall, again on a Friday. So we have several ICE offices in Canada, and they do not try to deport people from here. What they do is provide information maybe about terrorist threats, bad actors coming across the border, and that would certainly be helpful, especially during FIFA when a lot of people will be coming in. And our authorities have not necessarily covered themselves in glory with catching bad actors. But Olivia Chow made a motion. We don't want ICE here. And she further said, and they've been here for a while, this will make immigrant communities fearful. What do you think of that, George?
Well, I think that there's a extraordinary preponderance of the population, if I use those words well, that doesn't like ICE, that saw what ICE does, that saw the way ICE operated, particularly in Minnesota, with their faces covered and with no badges visible, etc. So I think she's on the right plane here. I don't want them here. I don't want them here.
They
either.
Are here, and they're not. They're bureaucrats. I mean, they're information officers.
They're spies. They're spies of a certain form, and they're informing to an organization which is conducting itself in an undemocratic and outrageous way. And I'm with Olivia Chow on this one. I want nothing to do with them.
Lisa?
I think it would be very difficult for the federal government to do anything about it. I'm great for the city to be able to put down the marker. But I will say one thing in terms of us kidding ourselves as Canadians that we don't need the United States for intelligence gathering, for safety, for defense. Well, you're kidding yourself. Because just this week, for example, there was a pronouncement by the U.S. Treasury where they are putting sanctions on a Vancouver-based company because they have done the investigation to determine that they were actually a financial front for Hezbollah. And, you know, that is something that we didn't have information on. They gave us information on a potential shooter in rural Nova Scotia that we didn't know about because they were surveilling it. These are things that are important in the relationship. So to, you know, kind of give them the middle finger as a result of this, especially with their bureaucrats, you just be really careful about how you manage the relationship. We would be worse off without having their capabilities.
Oh, and a bunch of the terrorists who were, you know, good permanent residents of Canada who were on the verge of a major attack. This was last summer. We only found out about it from the Americans, but hey, get rid of them. I mean, we know that we have IRGC members from Iran operating and laundering money, and we can't seem to get rid of them. Anyway, we'll have to end on my rant about that because we are out of time. Thank you so much, George Smitherman, Lisa Wright, and Peter Tabbins. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Okay, we're taking a break, and we are talking about the police have finally moved to stop these anti-Israel and often hateful protests from residential streets in the heart of the Jewish community, which is extremely fearful now because of these violent incidents, shots. So we are going to talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Toronto Police Services has finally responded to calls from the Jewish community to do something about the anti-Israel and often anti-Semitic threatening protests that are taking place weekly in the heart of the Jewish community. They're now saying that these protests are banned from Bathurst and Sheppard and the side streets around there, and this after numerous instances of shots fired at Jewish schools and synagogues, threats being uttered, and Toronto police have posted that they're consulting the Attorney General's office after the weekly demonstration, which usually has masked participants waving Palestinian and Iranian regime flags. But last week, they were carrying posters featuring really grotesque images of Jews that right out of Nazi Germany. This is something that has been escalating for weeks, months, years since October the 7th. So I am now joined by Karima Saad, who is a lawyer who is known for her video documentation of protests, anti-Israel protests, pro-Israel protests, a range of protests, and also Councillor James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so I have Karima in studio. I'm so glad to meet you in person, Karima. You actually go to most of these protests. So what do you think of this move? Of course, the protesters say this is limiting their rights.
So what police have said is no more marching down residential streets in the Bathurst and Sheppard area. So their protests can continue on the intersection for the time being. For those who aren't familiar with this particular corner of Toronto, shortly after October 7 in 2023, you had a group of local residents who set up a demonstration to support the hostages. And that went on for about 2 years until everyone was released or accounted for. At around the year mark, that demonstration started to attract counter-protesters. And so that's the group that we are referencing today who have outlasted the original demonstration. And just to your point, some of the things that people have found controversial, apart from their mere presence, are dressing up in costume to look like Hamas fighters or reenact certain scenes, marching down neighborhoods into driveways, chanting, and you referenced the signs that were particularly egregious. And I think that's what triggered ultimately this latest police directive, which is a departure, but not entirely, because some of the footage of these marches down residential streets drew heavy criticism. And you did have police at times kind of block them from going down, but that was not enforced in a consistent way.
Yeah, I mean, the marching down the streets, it is reminiscent of stormtroopers, Nazi Germany, Nazi-occupied Europe, and even Charlottesville, when you saw white supremacists marching with torches, yelling, "Jews will not replace us." Let's go to Councillor Pasternak. What brought this about in terms of advocacy, and what's your reaction?
Well, look, it's very welcome. It's overdue. I mean, to have these mobs and these protesters go through a Jewish neighborhood and harass the local residents for a conflict zone that's 10,000 kilometers away is totally outrageous and likely mostly illegal. So we have been working with police to make sure that the safety of the local community is protected. I mean, you mentioned, you referenced these signs that were displayed. These were posters. And if you didn't know what year it was, you would probably think it was 1930s Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
And that's how disgusting and hateful this has gone on. And there's been really nobody on the West Side. The hostages have long been released. And this group continues to come up. There's no town square. There's no consulates. There's no embassies. There's no government buildings. This is a Jewish neighborhood with many Holocaust survivors, and they are up there to harass us.
Yeah, and I was under the impression that covering your face like that in a lot of instances is illegal to begin with.
So in a protest sort of context, if a demonstration is deemed an unlawful demonstration, then there's a separate offense relating to masking up. Apart from that, there is no broad prohibition. And so you have people who are from head to toe, no identifying features. And then at times where there has been, let's say, more activity at that intersection, confrontations that emerge and no ability to identify who was doing what. And that's just a practical issue with policing protests across the city. You have people who disguise themselves and then behave poorly and are able to escape consequence as a result.
So in your opinion, I know that you're not a fan of limiting protest in general. What do you think of this move?
I think it's really unfortunate that this step had to be taken because in, you know, black letter law, we have the right to protest wherever. But there are circumstances, which the inspector on the scene enumerated, and to Councillor Pasternak's point, this response is somewhat overdue, where, you know, the balance between safety and civil liberties wasn't properly struck. And I think part of the issue relates to the protesters themselves and the tactics that they were adopting. This wasn't really a space meant to invite conversation or dialogue or meaningful exchange. This is insults and cursing and swearing and nothing productive coming out of it. And so I think that made the decision easier, but I don't love the precedent that it sets.
Uh-huh. Councillor Pasternak, one of the things, there are a lot of people who believe that there's just no enforcement, no protection. So do you have a sense of what will the cops be there to enforce them? And what's the remedy? Because until now, we have police saying politicians don't have their back. They don't charge people. If they charge people, they say, oh, the crowns are going to drop the charges, which is usually what happens.
Yeah, well, the blame game is chronic. I mean, I've been in touch with elected officials at all levels of government, provincial, federal, nonstop meetings with police services, of course, our municipal leadership, and everyone's blaming everybody. The federal government says it's a city problem. The police services says the Ministry of the Attorney General keeps dropping the charges, which is partially true. And of course, there's another group that says the laws are poorly written. It is a very small police force. They need backing from the OPP and the RCMP. That's not coming. We need the federal government to cut off foreign funding. But I think the other thing to remember is these mobs have cost us $45 million in police time. So instead of police working on traditional law enforcement issues such as robberies, break-ins, car thefts, rapes, stabbings, shootings, they are tied down by these mobs. And that puts the entire city at risk. In other words, if you need an officer, it's likely they won't be available because they're bogged down by these groups that are more interested in destabilizing the city than helping the Palestinians in any way. It is neo-Marxists, Antifa, communists who are out there to create havoc.
James, you didn't answer my question. How are the police going to enforce this particular measure? Or are they going to enforce it? Do you have any assurances on that?
Well, they enforced it last Sunday. They prevented this group from going into the neighborhood. How do you enforce any law? Well, you give people a warning. You have a significant police presence there to block it. And then if people disobey that warning, they can be arrested. That's how you traditionally enforce the law. Look, I got enough on my plate without running police services. So I am hopeful that they know what they're doing. But if these groups just step on police and march by and police do nothing, then that is breakdown in the rule of law and contributes to the chaos that we're all seeing.
Karima, are you going to be there this Sunday to see if this thing works?
I mean, for sure. Whenever there's a development, you can count on myself or my videographer being at Bathurst and Shepherd or anywhere around the city.
Okay. Thank you so much for doing that. Thank you both, Karima Assad and Councillor James Pasternak. Hopefully this works.
Okay. Let's hope. Okay. Take care.
You too.
Take care. Thank you. Right. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay. We're taking another break. And when we come back, we'll talk about our immigration system and some of the reasons for the breakdown there and what we can do about it when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we have to talk about immigration. Overall, Canadians favor immigration. So many of us are the children and grandchildren of immigrants, and our system of choosing immigrants used to be the envy of the world, but we have almost completely lost control of it, especially in the last few years. Now, that news has been coming in dribs and drabs. We recently learned that our authorities have been granting refugee status, asylum, to thousands of claimants without so much as an interview. And not surprisingly, some bad actors get in. And even when we identify who those bad actors are, we cannot seem to enforce even a small number of deportation orders. Now, just yesterday, the Auditor General, Karen Hogan, flagged some alarming but not surprising facts about our student visa program. So in 2023-2024, 150,000 of these student visas were flagged as being fraudulent. Being fraudulent means they say they're coming in to study as students, but that's not what they do. So only a couple of thousand were investigated. The excuse was that the department did not have the means to investigate them. And so aside from the ones that were investigators, the other cases just let go. And even when some of these students were found to have entered the country fraudulently, they get another visa to end up staying here. And the immigration minister has recently expressed concern that many foreign students whose visas run out just claim refugee status. So Michael Barutsiski is a professor at York University's Glendon School of Public and International Affairs, senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute, and he's the author of a report which I think says it all: When Asylum Becomes Mass Migration, Fixing Canada's Broken Immigration System. And he joins me now. Thank you so much for being with us. Michael? Michael, can you hear me? We do have him. It shows that we have him on the phone, but I don't know if there is some kind of problem. Okay, I see him on the screen. In the meantime, let me give you the numbers to call. 866-740-4740. 1-866-740-4740. And we're trying to fix a technical problem with the author of a report called When Asylum Becomes Mass Migration. As I mentioned just a couple of weeks ago here on the show, we were talking about how asylum has been granted to thousands of claimants without so much as an interview. And just yesterday, the federal attorney general flagged some problems with our student visa system. Michael, can you hear me now?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, so tell us about your report. I think the title says it all: When Asylum Becomes Mass Migration. Explain that, please.
Yeah, I think we've distorted the historic concept of asylum. So I think the way you introduced the show is great. Our system is being abused in many different ways. Many different immigration categories where we're sort of losing control, as you said in the introduction. So asylum is one of those areas. You mentioned also the Auditor General's report from yesterday. I've gone through it a little bit, but what she raises as a problem is not surprising. We've just become too loose and too flexible, too generous. So in some ways, it's nice to be living in a country that we're very open and we're trying to be generous. But that can lead to problems. We're actually starting to be naive and we're opening ourselves to abuse. So that's the general, I think, context.
So where do you see the most abuse? Is it in the student visa system or is it in the asylum system?
I think if you want to focus on abuse, I think it could be both. In fact, they combine in a sense. The minister has been warning, this is not a new problem, it's been going on for a couple of years, that the foreign students who are not here really to study, they want to stay here. They're not transitioning to permanent resident status. So the option to be able to stay longer is to claim asylum. So we've got thousands who are doing it at the moment. And potentially, because we have almost 3 million temporary residents, they're not all going to leave. And so that's the fear, is that many will start claiming asylum, thousands, tens of thousands in the past. And maybe that will increase and then our system is collapsing. So we've got, it comes back to, I think, that we've got a very generous approach. And then even asylum, how we go about defining who who deserves protection is, I'd say, sort of unparalleled. We're just going to, we're being too generous. So that is opening us for abuse.
Okay, so again, I believe that there is a bill to limit the amount of time you have to make an asylum claim to 1 year. Would that take care of the problem? It seems kind of nutty that you come here on a student visa and say, oh, by the way, I'm a refugee.
Yeah, so the Americans have been doing this for decades. Sort of, you have a deadline, a filing deadline. We're just starting to think about this. So this is an example of the government's aware, so now it's tightening visas. We're not just giving visas very easily. One of these new approaches is to actually have a deadline of 1 year, as you say. So it's interesting that that was actually sort of a, there was attempts to block that in Parliament. And so we're seeing it actually hasn't been approved, but it will be approved in probably the next few days. So the only concern there, so it's obviously it's a logical sort of step to make sure we don't have too much abuse. It's not going to fix all the problems, but it's a logical thing that we should have done before. The concern will be that what happens, so from a migrant's perspective, what happens if the circumstances in their country of origin change? So you do want to be flexible enough that, well, in specific special cases, you are examining the potentially changed circumstances. They came here as a student, they really did study for years, and then something happened in their own country of origin, and it's actually difficult for. So you do want to be flexible, but we have that in the system anyways. We have a pre-removal risk assessment that can even have an oral hearing if necessary. So that's already embedded in the system. So I don't see any problem to this new measure, as long as we actually do it seriously. But I'm not concerned about that. It's not the big problem in this country. The bigger problem is what you're alluding to. A lot of people are using this system. It's turning into mass migration. That was never the intention, I would say, of the whole asylum concept.
And a lot of people say that once people get this status, and sometimes even if they're rejected, they get gold-plated health care, sometimes more than what Canadians get.
Yeah, that's the issue I think you dealt in your show maybe a month ago or so, you referred to it. And so that's a controversy that's been going on for decades as well, since at least three decades. So it's what if the people are here, and even temporarily, if they're here for a year, do they get some sort of medical services? Can they go to a hospital? The issue has been in Ontario and Quebec for a couple of decades is who pays for this? And then what kind of standards? So eventually what happened is the federal government stepped in with their interim health program, federal health program. And what they're offering, it's varied over the decades, but at the moment it's actually quite, as you're saying, so it's actually more than many Canadians would actually have, including dental, vision, at least to some extent. So obviously that's sort of easy to criticize. I'd say in some ways that sort of if you're giving asylum claimants some services that are better than what Canadians, obviously the population is not going to react well. So in some ways this is, of all the problems out there, this is sort of low-hanging fruit. It's going to be criticized, that's obvious. We do have to offer some sort of service, but there are bigger problems. What you're alluding to is sort of just the massive fraud, a lot of big numbers, because all the numbers we're talking about are multiple times higher than they were just a few years ago.
Okay, we only have about a minute left, but what can be done to limit this, to take care of it?
Well, I'd say the bigger picture is the mindsets have to change. We actually have to think about sort of immigration is not just about showing that we're against them or against racism and we're trying to be open and generous. We actually have to think strategically and intelligent. We're managing a system for Canada's future. So I think the mindset has to change. And I mean that in a very like deep way within the department, within many segments of our population, that we sort of look at this a bit differently. Then we're going to adopt in various measures what you said about the 1 year deadline. So asylum claims, you don't come here for years and then you're, so we're changing that. We have to be tightening the visa policies and we have to actually take seriously enforcement measures. We've doubled the resources for the Immigration Department, also the Immigration Refugee Board, doubled the personnel over the last few years, but we can't handle the cases. So it's not about money, I don't think. It's about changing our attitudes and the way we go about being a little bit more, I hate to say this, more strict. We want to be nice and generous, but we also don't want to be fools.
Okay. We are just about out of time, so thank you so much, Michael Baritsisky. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Libby Znaimer. This is Fight Back. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.